Thank you so much for joining us. I have with me today the residency director of the University of South Florida, Hassan Mir, who's an expert on trauma and also the director of orthopedic trauma research at the Florida Orthopedic Institute. In addition to his interest in orthopedic surgery trauma, he's an expert on pain and pain guidelines, which all the other experts here said we need help with.
Well, thanks for having me here. I appreciate it.
Thank you. So, I mean, most experts, whether we had dental experts, family medicine experts, PA experts, every expert said we need help with guidelines. So, not one size fits all, but what kind of guideline help can you give us in understanding acute guidelines?
Sure. So there are several guidelines from multiple societies out there that deal with various aspects of pain control. In fact, the CDC published guidelines a few years ago dealing with the management of chronic pain. What we've noted in our subspecialty of orthopedics is that there's not a lot out there to deal with acute pain control, especially from musculoskeletal injury. So within our realm of orthopedics, we're a pretty small subspecialty overall. We're about 2% of all physicians, so only about 20,000 orthopedists in the US. However, when you look at healthcare overall, I think that our field of musculoskeletal medicine has a major role in that the vast majority of family care offices or primary care doctors and pediatricians, roughly half of their clinics can be filled with musculoskeletal complaints from patients. Also in the emergency department, there can be a huge number of patients who show up with musculoskeletal pain, whether it be from acute injury or from long-standing chronic conditions. So I certainly think that guidelines from our specialty as being musculoskeletal experts can go a long way towards helping other physicians and other prescribers, whether it be PAs or NPs, to help them manage various conditions.
So they might streamline what choices doctors might make, as well as help them explain those choices to the patient.
Right. I think that guidelines are a great starting point to have those discussions. I think that physicians in general are fairly independent-minded, especially my surgical colleagues, and don't necessarily like mandates. What's happened in response to the opioid epidemic is a lot of states have come out with prescribing mandates and limits and so forth. And I think that as specialty societies and as physicians, it would be more helpful for us to have clinical practice guidelines that are a starting point and help you with making these decisions of how to treat patients and not really a one-size-fits-all approach. Still leaving room for physicians to practice the art of medicine, but at least giving you a starting point, whether it be for managing conditions with medications, with opioids being one part of those that medication list, but also thinking about the patient as a whole and having cognitive strategies, having system strategies, having physical strategies. I think that when you have a set of guidelines that encompasses all of these things, it will certainly go towards helping physicians manage patients' pain, whether from acute conditions or chronic conditions.
Other physician groups look to you and they say, orthopedic surgeons are experts on pain, especially acute conditions. So even if a family physician might manage a finger break, they'd look to you for guidelines about what do you give for a broken finger. And if somebody had an accident, they would go back usually to a family physician after a major bone break, and they need to understand what your guidelines would include and what they should continue and support with their patients.
Right. So that's absolutely correct in that part of what's led to the opioid epidemic is sometimes there's too many cooks in the kitchen. We all share patients, and historically there weren't these databases that existed, and patients may have been getting prescriptions in different different guidance from different physicians. So part of the efforts that we've put forth with the Orthopedic Trauma Association and these guidelines for acute pain management is to make recommendations for what a taper looks like for opioids for these varying conditions, whether it be a major surgery, a minor surgery, or a non-operative injury. And then also allowing for alternative treatments, in that historically, people shied away from using non-steroidal anti-inflammatories for fractures for concern that it may not allow the fracture to heal, but we know that that's not necessarily the case. And so now, personally, in my practice, and there's several orthopedic surgeons out there now who give all of our patients anti-inflammatories acutely after an injury without any detriment to their bony healing. So there's different things like that that can go a long way to dispelling myths and to helping patients control their pain and not depend on opioid monotherapy to do so.
That's really an interesting addition to our thinking, because sometimes these old wives' tales, like anti-inflammatory wives' tales, just have a life of their own. There's really no evidence. There's maybe a few patients out of 100 for which you might think otherwise.
Right, so the only patients that I wouldn't use an anti-inflammatory in now are patients at high risk for being on anti-inflammatories with significant ulcers or significant renal disease, or those who are at high risk for a fracture not healing. Say I'm treating them for a fracture that didn't heal the first time, or they're a poorly controlled diabetic or a heavy smoker. So in those instances, maybe you consider going away from those medications. But in general, I think they're safe for the vast majority of our patients and we use them. And then moving beyond drugs, of course, is the cognitive side, which I think it's kind of odd, and a lot of the folks here have thought it odd, I think, that an orthopedic surgeon is talking about the touchy-feely aspects of medicine.
We didn't think it was odd. We thought it was great. We said, gee, this is a new age.
Right, but to talk to patients as if they're more than just an injury or more than just the bone, right? There's a whole person there, and I think that if you look at other aspects of patient care, then that can certainly help with managing their pain.
The use of ice and heat, how do you understand that?
So there's really good evidence on cryotherapy and being an adjunct to pain control. And a lot of times people ask us, well, does it work through the splint or the cast? And it actually does. It's been proven in multiple studies now that the ice still works even through the splint or the cast, because that's one of those myths that we mentioned earlier that people think it doesn't work. If I have a cast on, no, it still works.
How did the CDC guidelines relate to your own society guidelines?
So the CDC guidelines that were put out in 2016 mainly dealt with chronic pain. And while there were some musculoskeletal issues in there, it didn't really address what to do with patients with acute post-surgical pain or acute injury. So our group with the Orthopedic Trauma Association really wanted to come together and put together guidelines to address these scenarios. And they have been vetted and reviewed, and they will be published soon. And we do plan to make them open access so they're available not only for orthopedists to utilize, but for all subspecialists to utilize, whether it's primary care or ER or anyone who's managing our patients.
Did you put together anything that doctors who treat or evaluate pain might use as a toolkit?
Certainly. So with the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgery, on our website there are toolkits available that help to evaluate patients with risk assessment, with difficult conversations. There's several resources available there on our website.
I've heard you speak, and you've made everyone in the audience think about the whole person. And even orthopedic surgeons must be saying, what's with this? I thought the person was equal to the x-ray.
Yeah, so as I mentioned in our discussions earlier today, we actually have had symposia at some of our national conferences that are titled, It's More Than Just the X-Ray. And so this is to get our colleagues to think beyond the immediate result. A lot of us went into orthopedics because of the instant gratification, You see something broken, you fix it, you move on, and have the patient moves on to a successful outcome. But part of that process is to help patients through this in managing their pain. And you have to realize that there's a whole person attached to this. They can have potential life stressors going on. Nobody really plans to wreck their motorcycle or break their wrist in a fall. So it's going to impact their ability to earn a living. It's going to impact their ability to just manage their lives. And there can also be post-traumatic stress involved with some of these situations. There can be their own personal history of substance abuse or prior history of opioid use or chronic pain. There can be a whole host of things that go into this. So just having simple discussions with your patients, I think we can sometimes realize that we're not actually treating pain necessarily when we prescribe opioids or prescribe other medications. We may actually be treating anxiety or depression. And while we're not experts at treating those conditions, we can recognize them. We're all physicians. I think that if we just spend the time to talk to our patients, we can uncover other issues and at least direct our patients to where they will best be managed.
So it really isn't the end of orthopedic surgery or acute intervention to have restrictions on prescribing?
No, I mean, I think that we do prescribe as part of our practices. It's our responsibility to manage our patient's pain postoperatively, but only to a certain point. That's where some of these guidelines help, in that we prescribe and we taper down. And once you get to a certain endpoint, if the pain is persisting, you really have to dig and figure out, is this really still pain? There's obviously a lot of individual variability in this, right? There's a difference between nociception, which is just a stimulus that triggers a nerve ending and sends a signal to your brain, and what we perceive as pain. You and I could each get hit in the kneecap right now, and we may respond completely differently with our pain response based on our own physiology, based on our own backgrounds, our own level of stoicism. There's a lot of cultural things that go into pain as well. So I think that individualizing those things goes a long way into treating our patients as a whole. But to keep it simple for practicing clinicians and busy practices, just talking to patients for a couple of minutes will save you and your staff potentially several phone calls and a lot of pain down the road. And just helping with regular life stuff, whether it's return to work forms or a temporary handicap tag, or just talking to patients about how they're dealing with things, can go a long way towards helping them alleviate some of the anxiety and depression that may be masking itself as a complaint of pain.
So it's really interesting for me that within your guidelines, you almost have built in addiction medicine principles of tapering and discontinuation and switching. And that's novel. It always seemed to me that if someone had an accident or an orthopedic surgical procedure, that they were just given so many opioids that they wouldn't even remember to call their orthopedic surgeon again, let alone at night.
Yeah, well, that was the historical practice. It was just easier to write a huge prescription with a giant number of opioids. It saved you the hassle of dealing with patient calls or patient complaints. But I think we've realized with the current epidemic that we have to prescribe more responsibly, and that we have to limit the number of opioids we use and use alternative medications. Also, with state laws in many states, you can't prescribe the numbers that you did before. So it requires you to be a more complete physician and discuss some of these other issues.
So is it safe to say that after a couple of weeks, a person with persistent pain complaints has something different going on?
It's possible. Now, certainly you don't want to neglect real issues that could be going on. Surgeries can have complications, or some people may just have a longer lasting pain response. They may be going through rehab, et cetera, that's causing it. But I think that there certainly can be other things such as anxiety or depression or life issues that are manifesting themselves as pain. I think that in the vast majority of my patients now, since we've gone to these newer protocols, a lot of times after a few weeks, many of them are weaned off of opioids and instead are asking for refills of anti-inflammatories or acetaminophen, which we actually give as prescriptions for our patients. Mm-hmm. That's been a huge change in our practice, is that when you give a true prescription for an anti-inflammatory or acetaminophen, patients realize that these are true medications and not just over-the-counter, buy them and take them. They're actually medicines that we're prescribing for pain relief, and they appreciate that more. There certainly is a psychological effect to giving prescriptions for these medications.
So what would that prescription look like if I was to write one?
So for example, instead of just telling the patient, just go get some Advil or Tylenol and take it, we'll actually prescribe the Tylenol scheduled, 1,000 milligrams, Q12 hours or so, especially if they're still taking a combination opioid to make sure we stay within the safe bounds of Tylenol. And then for Advil, 600 milligrams, PO, Q, 6 hours. Just schedule it and try to stay within safe bounds and try to tell them about the potential side effects if you are prescribing the medications.
Would that cost them more?
It could actually potentially cost them less, because when you tell them just to go to the drugstore and buy it on their own, it's cash out of pocket, versus if it's a prescription, it may potentially be filled by their insurance. I know certainly when it's a workers' compensation case that'll be covered by through their workers' compensation.
I'm trying to figure out what you mean by prescribing responsibly.
So I think that goes into how we write our prescriptions and how we individualize treatment for our patients. So as far as individualizing treatment for our patients, I think it's great to have guidelines, but it can't be one size fits all. I think that there are different levels of injury that people sustain. So for example, in our Orthopedic Trauma Association guidelines, we're going to have it tiered for major injury or surgery, minor injury or surgery, and then non-operative injuries. So there will be different tiered levels of what we recommend as tapers. And within those, there will be an inpatient recommendation and then outpatient recommendations with tapers.
So like for major, you'd mean like break your hip?
Break your hip, break your femur, break your pelvis. So those sort of major injuries after a motorcycle wreck or a major car accident.
So how would that be handled, do you think?
So that typically on the inpatient side is going to be both multimodal and multi-drug. So I think that that's an important distinction to make, is that people sometimes confuse multimodal, which is multiple modalities, including physical modalities such as ice, elevation, compression, potentially alternative therapies such as aromatherapy, music therapy, all of these things which are evidence-based and really make a difference, versus multi-drug, which is, as we described, using opioids as just one component of an armamentarium of anti-inflammatories, gabapentin, Tylenol, regional or field blocks to help with patients' pain control.
And so that would be one kind of accident or injury, and then you could have carpal tunnel repair, or you break a wrist. Would that be considered more minor?
Right, so that would be something more minor. And for those, a lot of those procedures are done outpatient. And so we would recommend for those to have minimal to no opioids and a really limited amount. And obviously you have to individualize based on the patient. And again, that's where the guidelines allow clinical judgment from the physician. And you also have to be cognizant of the state that you practice in, because we all are legally bound by our state laws.
Thanks. So for the these guidelines that your society is working on, what kinds of ranges do you have for opioid prescribing?
So what we've tried to do in our guidelines now is to change the way that we write our prescriptions. In the past, it was pretty common that we would allow patients to take 1 to 2 pills every 4 to 6 hours and kind of leave it at their discretion. And for the vast majority of patients or their families, they would tend to max out the doses and minimize the time, so they actually use their prescription faster than what we really intended. So now I think our big push is to recommend that folks prescribe precisely and only write for one pill for the exact time interval that you really want them to take it, and then taper that down week to week.
So that's a big change.
That is a big change. I think that it eliminates some of the variability that existed, and you know, it takes away a little bit of the confusion for patients sometimes, because sometimes they don't know what to do, and they just know they're hurting, and they don't know if they should take one or two, or how, if they should take it every 4 hours or 6 hours. So it helps eliminate some of the variability, and especially now with using multiple different types of medications and multiple modalities, and telling them to stagger the doses for the different medications at different times, it's certainly having a profound effect. Because we're not using opioids as monotherapy anymore, we're using multiple types of medications on different schedules.
So do you expect like other orthopedic surgeons to adopt prescription, you know, like guidelines that are exact and precise?
I certainly hope so. I think that in talking with several colleagues around the country who have already enacted this in their practices and their groups, it's had a major impact in their practices, and especially with their groups. It actually is, it's not that much work to meet with your partners and set up a practice guideline based on your own subspecialty, your own locality. And then it really cuts down the work on your office staff and on the whole process. It makes it easier for patients because they understand the plan. It's a lot easier in the elective setting when you can really lay this out, but even the acute trauma setting, you can lay it out. And it goes a long way towards making things streamlined and understandable, so patients have a good expectation of what's going to happen.
No, I can see how that makes a great deal of sense. I just was wondering about the adoption. We'll see.
The adoption, we'll see. I think I'm a hard-headed bone doc, just like the rest of us out there. But once we did the work and actually started doing it, it actually has made our lives easier. So I hope that a lot of colleagues in orthopedics and other surgical subspecialties, and then a lot of our colleagues in primary care or the emergency department, will look at these guidelines and from the standpoint that it'll make practice easier to have something to fall back on. Not a mandate, but something that you can fall back on to help guide your own clinical practice.
No, I mean, it makes a lot of sense for me. I mean, is it one or is it three? Is it one or is it two? Is it, I mean, it's a big 100% difference.
Yeah, I think when you prescribe precisely, it eliminates the doubt and the confusion.
Thank you, Hassan, for being here and sharing your insights on acute management of pain and pain guidelines.
Thank you very much for having me.